using the parliament, Wednesday the 25th of May, 2022. Suspension of standing orders. The Honourable the Chief Minister. The standing order 73, to suspend standing order 71, in order to proceed with a government statement. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Minister, the government has agreed to the grant of immunity for the district deputy premises. The immunity has been granted to Diana Procco, which is part of the Diana Limited group of companies who have today announced their acquisition of TikTok. The Diana group are an expert utility business based out of the United Kingdom. The ultimate beneficial owner of these companies is Simon Gillay, a British UK based entrepreneur. I think I recognize Mr. Gillay in the gallery today. The alternative control protections are included in the new lease, which are not provided for the old lease. The new lease terms meet three of the GFLP Liberal 2019 manifesto commitments. These commitments were to renegotiate the lease so that the deckyard is operated in a manner that does not pose a health risk to the surrounding areas. It is now specifically provided for when the lease is a key performance indicator. Second, that the government is able to ensure that the shipyard is operated in full and proper compliance with the highest environmental standards. This is now further provided for by the inclusion of another key performance indicator, requiring adherence to three defined ISO certificates and the application of relevant Gibraltar law and pollution and environmental protection. I book means that this will take our commitment to best industry practice and the production of best available technology. And thirdly, Mr. Speaker, there is a transition agreed in the list to shore power, also known as cold ironing. And this will have to be provided under the lease obligations within 3 years. The means to follow months of collaborative discussion between Diana and the government. I have about the financial secretary, Adam Manner, for his work on this, as well as John Paul alongside him, with the support of land property services throughout our land property agents. In addition to our manifesto commitment, there are also various other government objectives that have been hardwired into the new lease, representing a significant improvement over the previous lease. In this respect, the lease now includes environmental, operational, and financial key performance indicators, some of which are entirely new, and some of which have been carried over and updated from the previous lease, such as the minimum number of residents and employees required. Residents of the area in particular will particularly be very pleased to hear that any emergency works will no longer be allowed outside of the hours of 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. or 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. Under the current lease, works can continue throughout with no specific reference to noise being curtailed. Work now outside of those hours will only be permitted on the basis of an extenuating works license, which will only be granted for work for railway vessels or for works which the government accepts are urgent. Noise will therefore become an unwelcome exception rather than a constant unwelcome norm. There are also those other terms that are sensitive to Balearna's growth plan, with the government keen to give Balearna the greatest possible prospect of success for its new business venture in Gibraltar. The government first referred that it was important at this challenging time in our political and economic development as a result of Brexit to keep the Rock Deckyard operational as a shipyard and provide a continued element of diversification to Gibraltar's economy at this time. We consider this issue with the benefit of the advice of the Minister for Economic Development, whose relationship with the dockyard goes back at least half a century, which I think is a fair portion of the period in which the dockyard has existed. But the feeling of my thank you, Mr. Speaker, that he has been an elected representative of the people of Gibraltar, some part of which was also spent as a trade union leader, spending many days and hours in the dockyard with the government. In this respect, Mr. Speaker, we will all be happy to hear also the release now built in on the continuation of an apprenticeship scheme going forward. As a result of these arrangements, the government will immediately start to work closely with Diana to also explore the feasibility of constructing an access lane through the shipyard that would connect Kingsbury Road and Rosia Road. I'm sure the speaker, all of current requirement. Today, we have delivered one citizen suit which involves modern day environmental obligations. The terms of the new leases have been negotiated on highly positive principles. As a government speaker, we've been ready to help out and play our part. I'm excited to see what the future is going to bring to the dock, its employees, and its new owners. I think it's a change to congratulate the new owners on the acquisition of TikTok. The Dutch are represents a key part of Gibraltar's real estate, and I therefore welcome them to Gibraltar. I wish them great success in their operations. And their commercial success as a company will be our economic success as a nation. I'm encouraged to see the drive and energy shown by the new owners who seek to grow the Gibraltar business from strength to strength, while reducing the negative impact that the previous operations have had on the surrounding area. I consider the acquisition to be more than simply an acquisition of TikTok. This is an investment in TikTok and in Gibraltar. Given the vote of confidence in our economy at a sensitive time now. The bigger completion of the deal at this time, with other competing priorities, is also proof of the government's relentless desire to continue to grow Gibraltar's economy and our success in attracting quality investment. The speaker, given the seminal importance of the backyard in our commercial, military, economic and political history, I am exceptional, and without establishing any precedent in doing so, laying the new leases on the table of the House for all honourable members now in the United States. I think I'm grateful for you to have made this statement. This is Honourable Eric Smith. Welcome the statement by the Chief Minister and look forward to digesting the leash that he is currently setting up to the table of the Parliament. Just a number of observations and one question for clarification. Welcome the change in control and the commitment, of course, to the environment first and foremost and to the working hours that has been the bugbear of many residents of the census, which can indeed, thank you. In relation to other areas of Gibraltar that complained about noise pollution and the working hours at TikTok. Just one point of clarification in relation to those environmental KPIs. How is it that the government is going to monitor compliance? That will be a key question that the member constituents will undoubtedly have running into the rooms in the future. And so there's the exception that the Chief Minister spoke about in relation to the Royal Navy, which I think is understandable, but obviously we need to look into that as well. In relation to matters for which the government considers urgent, has the government formed any view as to what that test is the best and that test what urgent means in that context? Because I would just call this that we still might see those hours, those 8 p.m., 8 p.m. Breakfasts being attended in some way, but if it is the urgent work that needs to be conducted, and I'm sure that the whole community will support that if it matters are urgent. But if the Chief Minister might just explain what he meant by that further, then I'd be grateful. Thank you, Speaker.
The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Sorry. Mr. Speaker, I don't think the Speaker is coming up to make this announcement to vote in the way that I have, and I want to do so. For the reason that it's out in my statement about the seminal importance of the decade in our political and economic and social history, as I've already provided for, but not recently, Speaker, because of how this was handled last time it happened. And that's what we remember, because of the last time that there was a transfer of studies. We do want to have a situation where the private conversations of the lending of the opposition were bandied about by other members of the world on this side of the House. So, I think it's important that we put it into context to the way that the government is seeking to deal with this matter properly. And so I hope that one of the members do see the news, which I understand is now with them, and they will be able to digest it and not just be digested, because of course the comparison that they will have to make will be with the recent day of the debate when they were in government. And this is a considerable improvement for the people of the border, for those who will be running the yard and running who have acquired it, we have found a new symbiosis between Gibraltar and the yard, which we think is the modern symbiosis that is a result to find at this time, but which could also have been found earlier. And so, Mr. Speaker, in the context of how we will monitor compliance with the environmental KPIs, and the first point that I vulnerable members is that a quick reward can also continue to apply as it has applied to date, even under the old lease. At the same time, there are various obligations under the lease which reflect the role to go to and go a little further, because by setting out more clearly what those obligations are and what they imply and mean. And don't just use the governmental directive in the context of the environmental agency, will be how we monitor compliance with particular parts of our environmental scope, of course, and those parts of the lease which require compliance with environmental provisions. But of course, we will also have a role there as landlord, because by bringing said provisions into the lease, we have a power as a landlord, not just as a regulator of all of the space that is supported through the environmental agency. But recently we have been remembering the magnificent work done in that yard at a time, in fact, when there was a industrial action the unions then led by Sabreau and the government and all of Gibraltar to enforce the conversion of two commercial vessels into vessels that could serve to the forefront as part of the task force. And so I think, as we look back, we remember what it is that has been done at this yard and what it is that may need to be done at this yard at any time, although we've always taken time for peace and not in times of war. And I think the Royal Naval Assessment in terms of work that will have to be done to a vessel is one that everyone in Gibraltar will understand. It goes beyond the commercial. This is something that because it's about the Royal Navy, runs in our veins, and we all understand that exactly. In the context of everything, Mr. Speaker, the standard here will be one that is to be set, but it will be in the man-bites-dog category, not in the man-eats-state category. That is to say, it will be in the unusual category, not in the normal category. And so, Speaker, simply because something is commercially urgent, it won't automatically trigger that the government of Gibraltar will be prepared to grant a permit. There may be some things which are commercially urgent, which the government is prepared to grant the trigger and permit work. But that will be the circumstance that we believe it will be few and far between. What will the standard be? Where in government they pass a law that permits the government to grant that permit in respect of any activity in Gibraltar, commercial building work in Gibraltar. And in the last 10 years, I think we have used that power once, and we have done so very sparingly, I understand, in relation to the memory, something to do with the airport, the port, well, the lighting, etc. And so the standard will be a high standard. Honorable members have passed that law and immediately granted a number of permits. We have not done so. We are very conscious that people who live around this yard wants to be able to live their lives without the constant difficulties that some have experienced, those who live closer to the yard. And indeed, it is true that some of the housing that has been developed around the yard has come after the yard, but as honourable members who are legally trained will know, the fact that the nuisance comes to the boundary is no reason why it is no longer a nuisance, and therefore, we will be very careful, Mr. Speaker, to continue the work that we have been doing and have now seen materializing the police to protect all those who live around the yard at the same time as we protect the yard, its viability and its commercial ability to be a success for all those who work in it and for the Gibraltar economy, which includes all of us. I hope I've taken you the point so much.
The Honourable Rory Clinton. I have a speaker, I will also echo my colleagues who are welcoming the statement and any formal inward investment into Gibraltar at this point. We look forward to be welcomed, and I think we look forward to this new partnership that was set out in the week, which as a member of Tom's account, I've been quickly perused. And I noticed from a quick perusal of the particulars of the 35 year lease. And I question to the government, and I think there is a reduced rent, a debt rent, and a feeding rent, and the whole calculation based on profitability. And finally, the government provides in terms of immediate cash flow. What is there, and I can't see looking through the lease, where there was any form of premium paid up front, or if you can only track the first installment for 30-year rent of $50,000 in that rent. So, one of the members looked at the clause, the rent clause, and they will see that there are a number of different provisions. There's a provision on rent in the first 7 years, a provision in years 8 onwards, a provision if KPIs are failed, and a provision on rent increase. There are none of those in the lease that they agreed, and there was no premium in the lease that they agreed. This is an assignment of the original lease, dealt with by way of new lease, because there was a dispute between the government and the previous leaseholders as to whether they were holding over properly or not. But there was no premium in respect of this lease, Mr. Speaker, there was not before. And with the concept, Mr. Speaker, of the rent, the honourable members look at the spot rent, and they look at the reduced rent, as it's called, versus the market rent and the premium rent, all of which is set out in the document. They will see that this is a considerably better deal for the government and for the taxpayer than was the case before, Mr. Speaker. In the context of the term, the Honourable Gentleman is right, this is a 35-year term, and of course the terms need to be agreed on the basis of what needs to be done for them to finance the ability to enter into these arrangements. That's why the government has agreed that period, but there are breaks provided for the list of honourable members will be able to see. I think if you see that the premium set for the people of Gibraltar, for the taxpayer, is not just in the context of a much higher rent that is payable, but also in the obligation to maintain the number of locally resident employees, which is now fixed into the lease itself, which was not the case before, and the benefits, the environmental benefits provided for, and the cost, for example, involved in all of those, in particular, the coal ironing cost, which would otherwise have been a cost which the government would have had to meet, and the obligation, for example, to provide a 60-bed generator, which was previously an obligation of the government, which is now an obligation of the tenant, which they had to comply within 70 working days. So we have the obligation with big financial consequences, and that is the premium to the government, because we no longer have to put out for those costs. They are costs that are being taken by the local.
So then we have an honourable member who is seeking any further clarification. Order of the day. First and second reading. A bill for that to amend the University of the Gibraltar Act. The honourable Minister for the Environment, Sustainability, Climate Change and Education. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the University of the Gibraltar Act be read for the first time. I will put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the University of the Gibraltar Act be read for the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The University of Gibraltar Amendment Act 2021. The Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, the bill makes a limited number of amendments to the University of Gibraltar Act 2015. The principal element of the bill is to make the University operationally more independent. There are some other amendments that I will explain. Clause 3.4 section 2 of the Act that concerns definition. Clause 2.3 amends section 8.1 of the Act and aims to streamline the functions of a university. One of the questions that come up is crucial. It amended and is in the future there are further facilities, centers, or academies. The Act will not need to be amended as any new areas would be covered. Moreover, the amendments provide the university with the ability to respond to local and regional opportunities and needs as they arise. there was an undertaking, and the consultation with the minister, as opposed to with the minister's consent. The Vice Chancellor's power would include the ability to summon meetings for both faculty and other academic administrative divisions. Through secret and intercompetent privileges, to provide a suspended or expelled student with a right of appeal to the Public Services Ombudsman in place of the bill. Council student appeal to the bill. However, the main rule that a neutral third party will be making the final decision rather than the bill, which is attributed to the university. This also aligns with the university's academic regulations. The seven substitute section at the school level would provide for a registrar. The role is better defined, and the registrar's appointment is moved from the board to the vice chancellor, and the duty is in accordance with the university's academic regulations.
Graduate school
holding a degree in the wrong way. So perhaps there is some clarification on that point there. May help you to solve problems in the future. And perhaps Mrs. People would advise us, as you know, it could be more personal speaking an amendment to the wording in third reading or committee stage. But on the amendment, when trying to amend section 22, sorry, yes, section 21 has some words spelled out, and then section 22.1 and 22.2 as existing, I believe they completely. And then a new 22.1 says, separate to section 1, well, section 1 is this one itself now, and 2, which is what goes underneath, appointment to the board for people appeals up to 3 years. I think that would be separate to section 2 and 3, because no reference to number 3, or to section 3, which was the one I'm asking about now, about the enrolled degree-seeking students can only serve to the end of the academic year. And in the new 22.1, there's no reference to that section 3, which is now introduced, that is not supposed to be good. So, if another word I can bring to that at committee stage, but perhaps the minister may appreciate the time to look into it, or for me, then some clarification, so no need to raise the topic at committee stage. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
So, is there any other honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill?
In 2015, we established the University of Gibraltar through the Parliament. And it wasn't an act which we took, for example, from the UK. Because in the UK, before the most universities were established, the new world charter. Rather than to the Parliament. And we didn't look at the jurisdictions and their problems as to how other jurisdictions did that. But what we did in 2015 was to create something which was fit for Gibraltar, which was fit for a university in Gibraltar. And it was always thought at the time that because we were doing something new in a very large Gibraltar small jurisdiction with its own. Specific type of university. You know, there would come a time when some provisions in the bill, in the act at the time, would have to be changed. And we would have to learn through experience, learn through operational practice, learn through contact with students, the academic board, and the regulator, and then bring improvements to the act. So that was always in the making. But it could be 7 years, almost 7 years, since we had the University of Gibraltar Act. And essentially, this act, which was tailored for Gibraltar, almost in the middle of a dark, has stood at the time. And it is a testament to those involved at the time in putting this together, in scrapping this, in the drafting, in all the research and the trips that they were made to learn about how all this should be done. It's a testament to the very hard work of all of those involved at the time, but we are here now, 7 years later, making some what the minister has rightly described limited amendments to the act, which clearly are improvements to the act. And my understanding is that these improvements arise following discussions with members of the university, recommendations made by the regulator of the university, the Gibraltar Regulatory Authority, in order, as the minister has, as the honourable minister says, to make the university more operationally independent. And all of this is of course to be welcomed. At the time, of course, when we established this, we didn't have a regulator of university in Gibraltar. We had a Gibraltar regulatory authority, but the Gibraltar regulatory authority did not regulate any university or any academic institution. And therefore the feedback that we now have as a result of the practice of these last 7 years from the regulator, and for all those involved in the university, it was simply not available in 2015. And therefore, we created a model which has worked, and has worked very, very well indeed. But there was always going to come a time, close to 7 years, but that in itself is a testament to how good and how solid the legislative foundation of the university advice that it's taken 7 years for these recommendations to be made, for the practical implications for the practice of the act to be in place, and for these limited amendments to be made. The Honourable Mr. Williams makes a point about the issue of the degree seeking student in the board. And that obviously will be a matter for the Honourable Minister to answer the specific question. But let me say that I certainly recall that was one thing which was in the thinking of those putting together the act at the particular time that we brought this together. We knew that at some stage we would want to make an amendment, or the government would want to make an amendment to the act to bring in a provision such as this whenever other amendments were made, because it was always intended that it was a good idea to have a representative of the student body in the ultimate decision-making body for universities, which is the board of governors. And therefore, that is something that is certainly to be welcomed. Aside from the specific legislative provision, it is worth noting, I think, it is a good opportunity now that we're debating issues to do with the University of Gibraltar, that the University of Gibraltar continues to be a great institution and a source of great credit for me and for others who were involved in establishing the university, and for Gibraltar generally. It has become not just a useful, but I would suggest a vital academic component of what Gibraltar has to offer. It is recognized internationally, and it is well recognized, and it has an excellent international reputation. We have been, the university has been training Gibraltarians and others each year in greater numbers for almost 7 years. There are a number of courses aimed at professional development across various sectors in Gibraltar, which is benefiting many professionals in Gibraltar, many businesses in Gibraltar, and always looking to expand its offering. It has become what we, all of us who were involved in the time, hoped that it would become a beacon of excellence in the Mediterranean. So, even to the extent that we are now blessed, the university is now blessed with having, as we know, the Lindsay Hall as a chancellor. So, just to end, Mr. Speaker, I would like to pay tribute to the Vice Chancellor, Professor Kathleen Lafleda, the staff, the board, and everyone who is involved with the university for the excellent work that they are doing, and for the continuing expansion of the university.
The Honourable Professor John Cotten.
First of all, I would like to thank my honourable friend, John Murray David, for the important intervention. It is in fact a testament to the quality of this pioneering work where the university was set up, that we are able to now develop and mature the university with minimal changes, and at a time when we more or less expected the time would be right to move forward. And I completely support his praise of the university's vice chancellor, of the staff, and of the board. And the speaker, Mr. President, is absolutely correct. These chambers, which have the support of the university's board, have a result of their interaction with the university advisory board as the Gibraltar Regulatory Authority, and as the Honourable Mr. Kudu has said, this process could not happen at the time of the university was set up. And also, because while I've intended to sue the university aspires to international recognition, now it is actually obtaining international recognition. It is in contact with the university's internal, and it is in contact with the quality assurance agency, and then we have recommended that these steps are logical steps in the maturing of an institution such as the one that the Honourable Joseph Dupuy set up back in 2015. So it's a testament of that, and also proof of the ambition of the university to become ever more established in the international academic world. In relation to the points that the Honourable Mr. Harris has brought up, I agree with him. I believe that it is in our section 22.1
to improve the matter with aspects of the amendments in the committee. So, in a lesson to degree seeking would include master's and PhD students. It is not, in my opinion, include PhD students. And whether I intended to suggest an amendment at committee stage, I will resist the temptation, because this is a wording agreed by the board, and by my fear in this case, and agreeing to a change in what the board has recommended, I think it would be a little bit of a interference with government at a level which I don't think I should involve. If the board feels that they should extend this to PGC students, or indeed give my interpretation is incorrect, so that was a very, but then they feel that this is extended, and it should be a very, then I would bring another bill with this minor amendment to the House. That's a barrier to the board to keep their advice, which I am not able to do right now. So having said that, Mr. Speaker, I want to then commend the bill.
I'm going to put the question, which is that the bill to amend the Universal Vote Act be read a second time. Those in favor, those against, carried. The Universal Vote Act Amendment Act 2021. I think I have mentioned that the committee said that third week has a vote taken to bear the full honorable members of the week. All honourable members agree with the committee's terms on third reading of the bill to take into government. A bill for an act to amend the Employment Volume at Work Act 2014. The Honourable Minister for Housing, Employment, Youth and Sport. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to vote that the bill for an act to amend the Employment Volume at Work Act 2014 be read for the first time. I want to put the question, which is that the bill for an act to amend the Employment Volume at Work Act 2014 be read for the first time. Those in favor, those against, carried. The Employment Volume at Work Amendment Act 2022. I think I'd be honored to know that the bill now be read for the second time. Mr. Speaker, the principal senator has said that under the 2014 Act in the Employment Tribunal, which has resulted in the proceedings before the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeal, has shown that there are a number of issues concerning the interpretation of the 2014 Act. In particular, difficulties have arisen in relation to the meaning of bullying and the liability of employers of the act of employees. The Court of Appeal's judgment described the 2014 Act as a very timely piece of legislation, which Sir Patrick Elias the JSA went to state in judgment, quote, "It will be obvious from this judgment that I have not found this act easy to interpret or apply. There is a lack of clarity about fundamental questions, such as precisely what amounts to unlawful bullying, and when the employer will be personally liable for the acts of bullying of his employer. Parliament might think appropriate to amend the legislation to clarify these difficulties and important issues." The Court of Appeal made observations which can be summarized as follows. Section 4.1 cannot be looked into in isolation. Conduct in Section 4.1 must be viewed objectively in the context of Section 4.2. Section 4.2, for all practical purposes, contains an exhaustive list of conduct which amounts to bullying. Section 4.2a sets out the kind of conduct required under Section 4.1 and identifies the typical characteristics of bullying. Section 4.2a captures the main categories of bullying with B, C, and D, C as specific examples. It is difficult to think of examples of bullying which does not fall within Section 4.2a. Section 4.2c and D are single incidents that act should include at least
some of the government's characteristics of bullying behavior in Section 4.2a. This is where the First Amendment requires the replacement of the word include in Section 4.2 by meaning this would clarify the interrelationship between Section 4.1 and 2. Confirm that Section 4.2 provides an objective list and removes any doubt about the conduct required for amount of bullying. The Court of Appeal commented about the Section 4.2a capturing reference to bullying and that everything that else did include some of the characteristics in 4.2a had to be adopted by spelling out what is intended to capture by Section 4.2b, c, and d. For this will be done by adding the new Section 4.2a as follows. But we want to read for the purpose of subsection 4.2b, c, and d, the conduct in question must be through behavior as offensive, intimidating, abusive, malicious, or insulting. Mr. Speaker, the next amendment to this act is in relation to the liability of employer of bullying by employee. The liability under the 2014 Act is 2006-1, which states, except an employer A must not, in relation to employment by A, subject an employee B to bullying. It is immediately apparent that it is the employer that must not subject an employee to bullying. It is therefore the act of the employer that must be looked at in consideration whether there has been bullying. The problem is that bullying will often not be an act of an employer. In most cases, it will be an employee that suggests another employee to bullying. The fundamental problem with Section 6 of the Court of Appeal decided is that 2014 Act does not give rise to vicarious liability on the part of employer for the act of the employee. Vicarious liability is a secondary form of liability which only arises when there is a primary liability by the employee. In the case of 2014 Act, there is no liability at all of the employee and therefore no vicarious liability of the employer. In the absence of primary liability on the part of the employee, the only way in which the employer can be liable for the act of the employee is to attribute such act to the employer or to deem such act to be the act of the employer. The Court of Appeal noted that there was no provision, no equivalent in 2014 to the Section 47(1) of the Equal Opportunities Act 2006, which states, anything done by a person in the course of employment shall be treated for the purpose of the act as done by the employer as well as by him, whether or not it is done with the employer's knowledge or approval. Therefore, the bill proposes to amend the 2014 Act on the same terms as Section 41(7) of the Opportunities Act, Equal Opportunities Act. And this means 47(1), anything done by a person in the course, I'll just read that one actually, so move on. Primarily discussed this with the Honourable Mr. Rafina, who contacted me and some suggestions, and gave some suggestions of Mr. Rukuni, to see who has actually been the instigator of these amendments. I propose a further amendment to the amendment before you, to which I have given notice and set out in my letter to you. This is to be able to deal with an issue of the defense to the employer. This will be done by introducing a defense similar to that provided in Section 47(3) of the Equal Opportunities Act 2006. This is the third, that is 7(3), in the proceedings that are under this act against any person in respect of an act alleged to have been done by an employer, of which it shall be a defense that for that person to provide to prove to it that it took steps as were reasonably possible to prevent the employee from doing that act
or from doing in the course of employment that that description. So when it comes to both 47A and 47A1, sorry, and 47B of the Equal Opportunities Act 2006, a new section should be inserted, and this is the amendment which I have proposed, which is extra to what already was in the bill, so this is an amendment to the bill, which would be 7A1, subject to subsection 2. Anything done by a person in the course of employment shall be treated for the purpose of his act as done by the employer, as well as by him, whether or not it is done by the employer's knowledge or approval. And number two, an act done by a person in the course of his employment shall not be treated as done by his employer in the proceeding brought under this act. The employer proves that he took that step as were reasonably possible to prevent the employee from doing that act, or from doing in the course of employment act of that description. Mr. Speaker, I commend this bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? The honourable Durbin, the former.
Thank you. I firstly recognize and acknowledge the assistance that the honourable member has given. I was right at the conclusion with two points, and they were explained to me. Points that I had were clarified, and we were unable to enter into discussions with the honourable Mr. Gooley yesterday, where we were concluding this legislation. The focus of this particular bill is to take account of the liabilities which were before the Court of Appeal in the Governmental Castalia GOK matter. And that is precisely what this bill does. So in that sense, it is certainly an improvement. I think it's been very much focused on that, and it's dealt with those distinct issues, which are really the things very important or fundamental to the understanding of the bill. So there's definitely a civil improvement. And so I'm going to go through some aspects of this. The addition of the word means is involved, it's the substitution of the word included with means in a clause B2A of the bill, which in turn amends section 4 of the Act. In order to deal with an issue which is before the court, as to whether the four items in section 4, which matters which amount to bullying, should be considered exhaustive or not exhaustive. By the addition of the word means, in effect, my interpretation is to be confirmed by the honourable member, it makes it an exhaustive list, so that is now the second stone definition of bullying. Furthermore, there has been a further improvement because we now have the addition of a further new subsection to A under clause B2B of the bill before the act, which very clearly sets out in statutory wording that those examples, in order for those to amount to bullying, must include behavior which is, and then it has lists the adjectives which apply and occur and color the feature in section 4, to get it right, subsection 2, subsection A, which is offensive, intimidating, abusive, malicious, or insulting. I think that's going to be of great assistance to the law. To particularly in the field and to those who are all victims of this very vile and foul behavior. I asked a particular question as to why, I think you can clarify maybe, why it was the case that it was decided not to include the word persistence in guarantee, which relates to, if I may, Mr. Speaker, to punishments imposed without justification and changes in duties or responsibilities of an employee. In those two instances, if that happens, there isn't a requirement for that to be persistent. But this is the word that I just talked about in section, new section 2A, if it's passed in terms of it, it's likely to be passed, and we're going to have unanimous support, at least from the rules of the opposition. I think they say no. Is that action has to be offensive, intimidating, and so forth. And after explaining to me that the policy decision of the government is taken, and that's fair enough. So let's have clarity in relation to that. Speaking of the first one, there's one point that comes to mind. I want to make sure I don't leave anything out. And this would be the final content, and I would invite the other members of the group, I think Mr. DeGroote, you may have something to say about this, and Mr. Rowdy's put my discussions with him yesterday. He was doing assistance for the representative of this house while he's speaking, if he may. I raised the point that there was an implication as a result of a very important one, I must say, as a result of Clause 3, which includes New 7A, again, passed in a week. That's a continuing provision. And it's been read in favor of the conditional action 1, which I think is fair to say, I think it was possible for anybody in the House at the time that we talked about it on this side of the House, certainly not on the other side of the House, that if an employee does something, how is the employer made responsible? And that was the subject of arguments, I'm not saying debate, arguments before the Court of Appeal as to whether an employer in those circumstances could be found to be vicariously liable. But my honourable and learned friend, I think as a result of his arguments, said that it was impossible in order to impose vicarious liability on an employer without there being primary liability first on an employee. And therefore, this deeming provision was deemed crucial in order to address that problem. It is, in effect, and I don't say this in a derogatory way, but it's just like a copy and paste of the provision which I think the Honourable Member, Mr. Harris, mentioned earlier from the Equal Opportunities Act. So I went to that, and I saw that all the defense in there available to, I think it's employees. In that fact, yes. So I put that to the Honourable Member's office, and an explanation was provided that, in fact, there is already a defence available to employees in section, I think it's 6.5 of the Act, which is a statutory defence, so that therefore there was a basically in summary, so long as the employer has a willing at work policy in place and is properly implemented and have the adequate reviews and training and all the rest of it, and then there's a section 5B, which says that as soon as reasonably practicable, the employer takes all steps that are reasonably necessary to remedy any loss, damage, or other detriment suffered by the complainant as a result of the act or acts of which you complain. That provides the employer a statutory defense. But nevertheless, the government took my suggestion on board and was careful that there isn't a confusing interplay between the deeming provision defense or qualification or exception and the statutory defense which is already there. They didn't quite import the language in section 14.7.3 of the Equal Opportunities Act, but it was slightly amended. But I would invite the argument for the group to be made to address the House on that particular point of the circuit. I think it's going to be of assistance in the future in interpreting the provisions, precisely because I still think that there could be a room for some confusion. In fact, it is going to be possible, and again, I invite the other members to address this point I'm going to make. If you qualify for the exception under the deeming provision, if it's possible for an employer to have to get scot-free, even if that employer doesn't have a building at work policy in place. Which is something which I would have thought of this legislation would encourage all employers to have in place. So if you could address that particular point. I do appreciate that the wording is slightly different, but again, there's a third occasion by doing that one and number two to address on that point. And other than that, I think, Mr. Speaker, I'd probably be point to add to the decision that this side of the House, that is the EU side, will be voting in favour.
Does any honourable member of the House wish to speak of the general principles and merits of the bill? The honourable member to the podium.
First of all, I would declare an interest in this matter. Not on the legislation itself, but I was, as we mentioned already, professionally involved in the cases before the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeal, which have given rise to consideration for the impact of the Court of Appeal decision in particular and the advisability requirements and necessity to make these amendments. And I should also say, have also been involved in advising the government as to what that impact of the Court of Appeal judgment is and what the amendments that ought to be made. Speaker, having said that, the Honourable Minister has explained the background to these amendments, how they arrived, the issues which arose in the Court of Appeal, what essentially has been decided and how that has impacted on the Act as we have in 2013. The record two issues, in fact, there were four issues before the Court of Appeal. Two were substantive and two were procedural. We don't need to deal with procedural issues, but the two substantive issues concerned the meaning of bullying under Section 4.1 of the Act and also the liability of the employer. The issue of first the interpretation arose in respect of both the meaning of bullying and the liability of the employer, on which the Court of Appeal helpfully made some comments and interpreted the legislation in a particular way in order to give the judgment of the court in that case. As a result of those interpretations, we now know what the judicial interpretation of this Act is in respect of the meaning of bullying. So, strictly speaking, it is not necessary to introduce the changes in respect of Section 4 of the Act, because all we would need to do, anybody that is involved in any case or advisory work, we need to look at the Act, we need to look at judicial arrangements, and say this has been interpreted in this particular way. What could not be done is ignore the second issue, which is the liability of the employer. Because what the court has recognized is that there is in fact a lacuna in the legislation. It is something that, although vicarious liability was mentioned during the course of the debate in 2014, what none of us who were here and there are two lawyers, both on this side of the house, and there were a few lawyers on that side, but none of us realized at the time was that as a matter of law, vicarious liability and for the reasons that have been explained do not apply in respect of this particular Act. And that is something that we did not realize. It has been picked up as a result of argument before the court. There is clearly a lacuna in the legislation which needs to be remedied. And therefore, the second amendment that this bill is absolutely necessary. Given that amendment is necessary and it will require to bring legislation to Parliament, it was clear that this was an opportunity which was taken by the government in order to clarify the first issue, which is the meaning of bullying, by essentially giving effect to what the Court of Appeal has decided in proper interpretation of this particular Act. And therefore, the first part of the amendment, which seeks to change in to realize was that it was very difficult, in fact, to try to possibly to come up with examples of what could properly objectively be deemed as bullying conduct, which would not fall within one or other of the provisions of Section 14 of the Act. And therefore, the court was satisfied and said that for all practical purposes, Section 14 provides an exhaustive list. What the amendment does is clarify that that is in fact what is intended, and that is in fact what is going to be the case. The list is now exhaustive and is clear from the language which is now used, which now leaves no room for any doubt whatsoever. Then, remember, Equipment raises the issue of provisions in Section 14 requiring persistent conduct and others not requiring persistent conduct. A and B in 14, A talks about abusive, insulting, intimidating, malicious conduct and behavior. Two talks about objectified criticism, or rather B. Those require persistent acts. And it is now clear as a result of the clarification and the reading of the court that where the behavior question falls within those particular subsections, it involves criticism or it involves abusive or intimidating emotions, conduct, etc., those acts are required to be malicious for the purposes of falling within the definition of the law. It is worth noting also at this stage that what Section 14 does is spread out the meaning of conduct, where conduct is referred to in 4.1, because the basic definition of the meaning of bullying is in 4.1. Where it talks of a person engaged in conduct which has the purpose or effect of causing humiliation, distress, etc. Then, when you consider what does conduct mean, you now look exclusively at 4.2 and the list in 4.2. Because one of the difficulties that arose is if you look at 4.1 in isolation and forget 4.2 and see that a person engaged in bullying is, or rather, a person carries out bullying. It is he engages in conduct which has the purpose for effect of causing distress, etc. The question which arises, well, what does conduct mean? Does it mean any conduct at all? Does it mean any conduct at all which has that purpose or that effect? And what the court thinking has decided, and this is a very important interpretation, is that conduct does not mean any conduct. The conduct in question must be viewed objectively and be capable, when viewed objectively, as a non-human to bullying conduct. And that is why the court of appeal went on to say, well, the physical characteristics of bullying are actually in 14A, which is behavior, which is insulting, abusive, intimidating, malicious, etc. And given that those are the typical characteristics of bullying, those are the ones that permeate throughout all other forms of conduct to determine whether there has been bullying conduct or not. And that is what has given rise to the other amendment to Section 4, which is in the introduction that for the purposes of BCND in Section 2, some of the characteristics in A must be present, because those are the characteristics that define bullying. What is clear is that this Act is about preventing and providing remedies for bullying conduct. Not for any type of conduct which has certain purposes or certain events, but for bullying conduct. raised that the second issue concerns the liability of the employer, and the principal problem of this act is that it doesn't provide for liability by employee. It does not provide that an employee is liable for bullying somebody else, or that an employee must not subject another employee to bullying. It provides that an employer must not subject an employee to bullying. And therefore, given that there is only primary liability of the employer, there is this issue with vicarious liability, which is a form of secondary liability. The absence of that primary liability means that the employer is not vicariously liable at all. Although I recognize that I do not want to bore anyone with a legal language, just to put it in a practical context, so that the point is clearly understood. Let's take the example of a negligent surgeon who performs an operation, does it negligently, and causes harm to the patient. Typically, the patient, family of the aggrieved patient, will take action against the health authority involved, against the hospital, against the clinic, wherever, although they can also take action against the surgeon. The reason that the hospital, clinic, health provider, is liable is because it's where the surgeon is acting in the course of his employment as an employee of that institution, and because the surgeon is liable himself. So the surgeon can be sued, he has primary liability for his own negligence, but then there is secondary, or what we call in legal terms, vicarious liability on the part of the employer. And that arises only where somebody else in the course of employment. So that's a typical example of where vicarious liability arises. But you must be able to sue the person who does the act. You must be able to sue the person who is primarily liable, in that example, the surgeon. As a result, you cannot do that with an employee, because the act does not provide that an employee must not subject another to bullying or is liable for bullying. And therefore, there must be another way in which an employer can be liable, so that, as the honourable member has said, the employer cannot simply get a scot-free saying, well, that wasn't my action, and therefore I am not liable. We further there is a similar provision in the Equal Opportunity Act, Section 47(1), which is essentially a dealing provision. It treats the acts of employees when done in the course of employment as being the act of the employer. The purpose is saying that is not the same as vicarious liability. That is deeming those acts to be the acts of the employer, therefore the act is the employer is primarily liable and is caught by the provisions of the act. The other member raised in correspondence with a friend of the minister the issue of Section 47(3) in the Equal Opportunity Act, which provides a defense or exception to circumstances when an act of an employee will not be treated as an act of the employer. This is something that has been considered at the time when, certainly when I was looking into this and I suggested to the government what amendment was to be proposed. As the Honourable Member has said, there is already a statute in defense in the Act, Section 65, in the context of bullying in particular. Section 65 provides a general defense to the employer where the employer addressed the bullying at work policy, which is in the pursuant to the Act, where the employer implements and takes reasonable steps to remedy any loss or damage caused by any lawful act of the employer or one employee. So that provides a general defense. And the view that was taken originally was he's already got a defense, and he would be unable to have two statutes of defenses in the same act. But given that the point was raised and it was looked at again, it is clear to see that the section, what is now going to be Section 7A1, deals with something slightly different to Section 6.5. Section 6.5 deals with proactive steps taken by the employer. putting in place a policy and pursuant to that policy. 7A focuses on the acts of an employee and the circumstances in which those acts of an employee are to be treated as the acts of the employer. And there are a few occasions when the female overlap the issue of the proposed amendment to the exception when acts will not be treated as acts of the employer, and section 5, there may be some overlap. But exactly this will depend what the amendment is done. This is the focus of what it looks like in terms of whether the employer is liable or not, whether it has been bullying, depends on what the question being asked of the employer tribunal and the particular circumstances which arise in the case. So, if the question is the employer tribunal considering whether the employer has adopted and implemented the bullying at work policy and therefore has a general defense, it would look like section 5. If the question is different, and if the question is, are the acts of the employee to be treated as the acts of the employer, then the question will be slightly, the focus will be slightly different, and that is where 782 would come in. The other member raises the question, and suggests that there should be no room for the confusion, and we should not have a confusion overlap. I recognize because of that there might be some overlap. There might be circumstances where the employer has adopted the policy, has implemented the policy, and therefore says, in response to a suggestion that acts should be treated as this, and acted reasonably, this is what I've done. So it's possible that both elements can come into play, but there may be circumstances where, for the particular reasons with the planning of the particular case, the employer has taken little steps in respect of specific acts outside the policy, nothing to do with the policy. In respect of specific acts of an employee or a group of employees, an employer takes reasonable steps to prevent that happening, and that would allow the employer to say, well, in these circumstances, the acts of the employee should not be treated as my own, because I have taken steps only to prevent all this happening, separate from the policy. It may be that the policy is one of those steps. So the policy could be one of those steps. But there may be other steps that the employer takes in respect of specific acts, or specific employees, or specific groups of employees, which fall outside the policy, and will therefore allow the employer to say, in these circumstances, because I have acted reasonably, in these specific circumstances, these acts of the employee should not be attributed to me, and should not be made liable as a result. And that seems that we can do exactly like it will to the argument. Just two points. One is a general point of slight disagreement, but simply to congratulate you, that I'm finally taking this piece of legislation, which is actually that the Court of Appeals encouraged legislators to amend not just the issue about the dealing, which is a human condition point, but also what amounts to bullying. They made those two points and encouraged Parliament to make the amendments in order to clarify those two points. But it would include also the definition of effects, the exact definition of what amounts to as a critic under a form of bullying. But simply, and secondly, Mr. Speaker, just one point of detail, which you and I have discussed, but I guess this is just on the left of the house. There seems to be a new section 782 talks about the employer approving that he took such steps as a reason would be practicable. Anybody looking at this and the lawyer looking at this would assume, and quite rightly, that the standard of proof would be under a civil standard on the balance of probability. So it would be good to please clarify that just by way of a reminder before he did that. Mr. Speaker, yes, certainly that would be the intention of the lawyer. Whenever you have a provision where a defendant or a respondent in a particular case, the burden of proof is free, as a result of certain things being established, and the burden of proof is the defendant or the respondent, the burden in order to satisfy that burden of proof ground in the second bit in order to satisfy that the burden of proof will be on a guy's probability than under standard normal, what is known as a civil standard of proof. That is certainly an advice I understand, and I'm not part of the government, and one of the ministers in concern for the government, but that is also the government's understanding. But that would certainly be the intention of this particular provision, as it is in relation to the sector itself, the building of work policy. It would be for the employer to prove, in order to have that general defense, it would be for the employer to prove that he has adopted a building of work policy, that he has implemented it, and it is only the employer that can do that. Because the policy talks about training, for example. So certainly the employer can come along and say, I have trained up, I have trained well, this is how I have done it, this is how I've implemented the policy. So the burden is on the employer, and the burden would be satisfied on a balance of probabilities. If you think that, these are dealt with some of the issues of the Honourable Minister, who means that they may have other points to make, but it seems to do. Because this is certainly an improvement. It is listening to the court when they have interpreted. And as the Honourable Member has said, although we could simply have limited this to curing the lacuna which existed, this bill goes further, takes on board the comments of the court, the Honourable Judges, and in particular, the suggestion that Parliament might want to consider this, and that is the reason why this bill has been put to the House today.
Does the Leader of the Bill wish to respond? Yes, Mr. Speaker, there's certainly just there. It is great to see that on both sides we've been able to make amendments and improve a bill which has been there, which the Court of Appeal has actually indicated to us as legislators. Improve, and therefore it is great to see that it closes down what amounts to bullying in the first place, and the second place it clears out the liability of the employer to actions of an employee. So therefore, and it's been great to be able to be working on both sides to improve this case. But I'm going to go to work now.
I'm going to put the question, which is as a bill for to amend the Employment Bullying at Work Act 2014, being read a second time. That is in favor. Those against? Carried. The Employment Bullying at Work Amendment Act 2022. Mr. Speaker, I have the honor to move that this bill now be read. I beg for good notice that the committee says in third reading of the bill be taken today, whether honourable members agree. Do all honourable members agree that the committee says in third reading of the bill be taken today?
I have the honor to move that a bill for recommend free sign language as a language of the bill to require municipal policies report on the promotion and participation of the use of free sign language by public authorities to require guidance to the issues in relation to British sign language to be read a second
time. I'm going to take the question, which is that a bill for to recognize British sign language as a language of the bill to require the Minister for Equality to report on the promotion and facilitation of the use of British Sign Language by public authorities, and to require guidance to the issues in relation to British Sign Language be to vote a first time. Those in favor? Those against? The British Ballot System and Property want to confirm that the Honourable Minister has referred to me certifying that the bill was too urgent to permit expiry of 6 weeks. The British Ballot Language Act 2022.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to move that the bill for the British Bad Language Act 2022 be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, the bill is a pivotal and historic moment for the deaf community in Gibraltar, particularly users of British Sign Language. This bill provides for the recognition of British Sign Language as a language of Gibraltar and requires the Minister for Policy to report on the promotion and facilitation of the use of British Sign Language by public authorities. The bill also requires the Minister to issue guidance in relation to British Sign Language. Our ambition, Mr. Speaker, is for this bill to create a more inclusive society, improving the lives of deaf people and ensuring public services are more accessible for them. This will be yet another step in making Gibraltar a more inclusive society. Mr. Speaker, our government has always led the way in respect of providing British Sign Language support for those who need it in Gibraltar. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, we have been making provision for this for many years. In 2012, we established a contract for the provision of British Sign Language services in Preston at the Gibraltar Health Authority, and this was later extended to the rest of the public sector. And provisions were later also made to extend this facility to some languages conferences. Mr. Speaker, we're all British Sign Language is also very visible at events now, so events such as the National Day and other cultural events. Mr. Speaker, this government has been committed to the requirements of the deaf and hard of hearing community generally, in a way that is unprecedented than any other before. And this represents yet another step in our journey for the inclusion of people with disabilities. For example, Mr. Speaker, the provision of British Sign Language services at the government department, as I just mentioned, the provision of hearing across government departments, the provision of e-gov services that will make the interaction with departments a lot easier to communicate with electronically, the provision of tech services at the primary call center, and the WhatsApp service at the UK's 111 call center, which can also be used to dispatch other emergency services if needed. And I would also add that the 111 service also serves the mental health crisis line. Of course, Mr. Speaker, the icing on the cake will be the brand new audiology suite at the Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, this government has showed its commitment to the provision of British Sign Language by ensuring that government employees have been given the opportunity to learn British Sign Language at the government expense. At present, there are 17 public servants who have received some training in this regard in the BSL Level 1 or 2, and we are waiting for the current British Sign Language class to finish before embarking on funding a new group of training. This is, of course, Mr. Speaker, further work to do. I would like to take this opportunity, Mr. Speaker, to extend my gratitude to all those involved in making this a reality, but especially Mr. Speaker, Gita, and Mr. Joseph Rivera and his family, who have constantly and regularly worked with government in respect of our responsibility towards the deaf community in Gibraltar, and who have inspired us to do so. I would like to turn to the clauses of the book. Clause 3 includes a definition of relevant public authority, which means all government departments, authorities, agencies, commissions, corporations, or other bodies established by statute, and a person or body declared by the Minister or noted in the Gazette to be a relevant public authority. This definition is to speak and show that all public bodies are in scope of the Minister's reporting obligations under the Act. Clause 4 recognizes this by language of the language of the Minister. Clause 5 states the Minister must prepare and publish a British Sign Language report after each report to be around. The report must describe what each relevant public authority has done to promote or facilitate the use of British Sign Language in its communication with the public. Such communications include any public announcement which it makes about policy or about changes in the group, the publication, diet, or any plan, strategy, consultation document, or consultation report, or any one of the supporting materials, and its use of press conferences, social media, or a government website to publicize any of its activities or policies. The minister must publish its report no more than 3 months after the end of the reporting period to which it relates. The first reporting period shall be the period beginning on the day in which this act comes to force and ending with the 30th of April 2023. Clause 6 states that the minister must issue guidance on the promotion and facilitation of the use of British Sign Language, guidance going forward, advice for relevant public authorities on providing information to the minister, advice on best practice for communicating with British Sign Language users, and case studies to illustrate the value of providing British Sign Language interpretation and communication to the public. Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that the Ministry of Equality is already one step ahead and has already drafted the first set of guidance notes for this act, and preparations are already in place to reach out to all relevant bodies to ensure that the duties under the act are fully understood and therefore complete. Clause 7 includes a regulation making power in respect of matters relating to the application of this act, and for more effectively carrying into effect the object of this act. Mr. Speaker, I commend this bill to you.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? The honourable
Mr. Speaker, thank you. Recognition, of course, Mr. Speaker, will support the bill. I'm agreeing with the honourable lady that it is a historic and seminal bill before this House, namely the British Sign Language bill. And the reason why I've done a certain Sign Language I've learned over the last couple of weeks is to hopefully present to our community that even MPs on this side of the House are able to look at a bit of Sign Language now that we are recognising fundamentally British Sign Language as a language of our community. So I'd like to say, in relation to the deaf and hearing loss community, Mr. Speaker, a big thank you to our deaf and hearing loss community, Mr. Speaker, because I think it's important that on this seminal day that members of this House attempt to learn British Sign Language so that we can do our bit, Mr. Speaker, as well as those members who are going through the training courses that the Honourable Lady has articulated before. It is important to reflect on how this bill came about. What it seeks to achieve, what more can be done in this area, and fundamentally, Mr. Speaker, to honour those who have made it their life work to improve the lives of the deaf and hearing loss community. Mr. Speaker, I will draw those close working relationships, as I know the Honourable Lady has with our deaf and hearing loss community, and I'm very pleased that the government has listened to our community and, Mr. Speaker, their opposition. We note that we have played our part in bringing a motion for this House to encourage law in this area, and, Mr. Speaker, we are pleased to see the government follow where we have led politically on this issue, Mr. Speaker. But today, Mr. Speaker, is not about political quote drawing, as I did say in relation to the question that was put before this House last week. Today is about unity across the floor of this House. Today is about the celebration of deaf and hearing loss rights, and today is about setting aside discrimination, and today, most importantly, is about establishing a platform, Mr. Speaker, for us to put into action the steps that need to be taken to provide important resources to our deaf and hearing loss communities. Mr. Speaker, the people that should be affiliated for this bill are our deaf and hearing loss community. We have for decades been ignored, criticized, successive governments, in particular the federal government who have been in office for the last 10 years. And right this bill will finally recognize British Sign Language and is supported by our deaf and hearing loss community. Much, much more work will need to be done on the ground to make provision of British Sign Language in our community a reality. So it is certainly about, as the Honourable Lady has said, a step in the right direction. is receiving a royal assent from the British Parliament. He says that the bill is still to celebrate. We are all aware that this marks the first step on a long path towards truly equal access to public services, information, and opportunities for BSL users in Great Britain. Mr. Speaker, the same is seen here in our home, where in responding to the publication of the bill, he said, Chairman, as we see out of the as a milestone, but one that leads to the next real action with the establishment of the BSL Advisory Board on implementation of the provisions of the Act and rolling out of information into European educational establishments. The hard work, Mr. Speaker, doesn't stop at the passing of this legislation, and right for the first time recognizes British Sign Language as a language and is a welcome step towards a more inclusive and accessible society. The proof of the pudding, Mr. Speaker, is in the meeting. And we must ensure the daily lives of our deaf and hearing of communities are improved by better access to BSL provisions across all public services, most importantly, education and health. The Speaker is an initial step in building a roadmap so that the deaf and hearing of communities can access services where there is a lack of provision. I must say, Mr. Speaker, when the deaf community approached me 8 months ago, and since the High Life Net, I was shocked that in 2022, who effectively cannot provide BSL interpreters qualified and experienced so deaf members of our community can communicate with our doctors, nurses, or arguably or other public services, Mr. Speaker. You only have to, for one moment, and I think I was responding to a question that was put in this house and which has been voted on, you only have to reflect for one moment the daily basis and the impact that hearing and speech have on everyday life. Not to be able to communicate with your doctor about how you feel so that a diagnosis can be properly informed. Not being able to tell your teacher about the support you need at school. Not being able to tell a pharmacist what medication you need. And not to understand an emergency situation such as when a fire alarm is triggered. And not being able to watch the news, which is importantly, in order to understand what is going on in your community. Great for businesses, you can have to understand that you've been able to speak with masking for the community and indeed, potentially this afternoon in relation to TikTok. Speaker, we need to make sure that the bill before us passed is not a token bill, but that there is a meaningful and genuine understanding within government and the wider community of the real and urgent need to back this bill with action. Namely, the provision of BSL support qualified interpreters across our public services, including broadcasting, Mr. Speaker. We will support this bill, Mr. Speaker, we said. It is a start, it cannot be a token bill. It must be a signal to our deaf community that we hear you and we have your back. We must now, without delay, Mr. Speaker, take important steps to increase accessibility so that our deaf community feels included in our community. Lastly, Mr. Speaker, I wish to recognize, of course, Peter Edelman O'Kafuri, Joe Guerrero, and many others who have put forward in relation to deaf and hearing loss rights. And of course, Mr. Speaker, Bobby and Anna Maria Ronald, who in their massive walk from Gibraltar to the north of the Iberian Peninsula, and whilst in Christmas, speaking this air conditioning chamber, they make me back at half a mile from each day, in the 14th Spanish day, Mr. Speaker, to raise awareness of their issues in our community. We must match this massive effort, Mr. Speaker, and let us forgive them and recall the daily struggles of our deaf and hearing loss community by ensuring that full fair resource is made a top priority. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
I welcome this very long overdue bill and commend the civil society group whose lobbying has made it possible. And clear that thanks to the wealth of the department has given us all an example of how to unite to achieve lasting political change, and the efforts have been extremely successful in giving us visibility to a collective that has been marginalizing the voters for far too long. In this case, Mr. Speaker, with the work of Peter and in particular of its chairman, Edgar Clare, that deserves praise and recognition. Mr. Speaker, I also think it's fair to thank the Honourable Emma Phillips, who presented this topic and the motion following an appeal to MPs in the House by BSL advocates, and a motion that has in turn spread this bill. Unfortunately, Mr. Speaker, we have seen in the past policies such as this will often become a purely symbolic exercise. This bill will be empty of such accompanied by vigorous implementation, the investment of public resources, and a profound cultural and institutional change. Finally, Mr. Speaker, and together we are far from providing adequate levels of accessibility for deaf people and ESL speakers. Mr. Speaker, government, press conferences, and other institutional messages are also not by default subtitled, and therefore still not inclusive for deaf people. We need BSL interpreters in public culture, educational and healthcare environments, and the widespread introduction of hearing loop infrastructure in our society. We need BSL to be introduced in our education system in order to bridge the hearing divide that exists in our society. We need to do much, much more to ensure that we provide equal opportunities to the most vulnerable members of our society, and I hope that this bill, which I shall be supporting with my vote, is the first of many changes to come. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Does any other honourable member wish to contribute? The Honourable Professor John Gauthier.
Mr. Speaker, I will let my Honourable friend, the Honourable Sir Michael Sacramento, rebuke the perfectionist claims of the Honourable Mr. Phillips that we have followed anything that they do. We do for everything else for that matter. We follow values we wouldn't have got anywhere in the past 7 years and all the representatives that we have been there. But the same Mr. Speaker that happened. And years ago when I was Minister for Health and my Honourable friend was Minister for Care, we worked very closely together and we took one more step. Boom! As a sense to approaches from Peter and from Mr. Rivera and his family, because the truth was that there was absolutely nothing in place to support and help those who had hearing impairment. We took steps then, and we remember some of them, including the messages for the health center, the provision of online connections when there was a need to have a consultation with somebody who could work in some language and many other things which were not in place at the time. And today's step, as we all agree, is a hugely significant one. I want to congratulate my friend, the Honourable Francis Sacramento, especially on knowing how determined he is in everything he does. I'm absolutely convinced that it will not just be something that lies in the statute book and that we are making tremendous progress and will continue to do so in the future.
The Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I want to agree with one of the things that Mr. Phillips said, which is that today is a historic and seminal moment. It is a historic and seminal moment because we are adding a language to the official language of Gibraltar. And that is not something that can be done easily. It's not something that can be done without considerable thought and considerable preparation. And so today is historic and seminal. And I just know I would have described the presentation of this bill by the Honourable Lady, the Minister of Responsibility for Equality, if he had not described it in that way himself. But so we are in agreement. The civil assembly is historic and seminal. It is a pity to say that moment with party politics. But that is exactly what the Honourable Gentleman has done. The Honourable Professor Kutterson has been absolutely right to say that there's no question of this government failing honourable members. Absolutely no question, because honourable members have presented policies in this House which were entirely contrary to the progress that he had represented. Every time since we were elected, the good work that they have told us to do is not to open the Development and Planning Commission to the public, not to facilitate the minutes, but to keep them entirely confidential as they were. And when it comes to the particular issues that we're dealing with, the government is not for one moment following a motion that the Honourable Gentleman put without consulting with the government, that is to say, without gauging whether or not the government could support it. This government is following the advice of the Minister with Responsibility for Equality, the advice of those advised by her, and to the work done by people. Not just in the work that they've done recently when they were outside my office and I was able to become involved in the discussion with them, whether it's really a lot of the issues about DSA in particular, how DSA has been in the process of becoming an official legislator for language in the United Kingdom, not just in the context of the Westminster Parliament's legislative action, but in the parliaments of the nations that make up the United Kingdom, in the Welsh Parliament and the Scottish Parliament, the last one being the British Parliament for England rather than just for that one or for the whole United Kingdom. It is therefore, in my view, totally wrong. It is totally misleading of the public to suggest that the government is somehow following the opposition. In fact, what all the members need to reflect on is that this is a government bill, not an opposition bill, or a private member's bill, which is what the Honourable Gentleman has made and called for. This is a government bill. Being given government time, it's going to be passed with government vote, and if there is anybody who is entitled to claim the credit for this, it is the NGOs, the ones that the Honourable Lady mentioned, Peter, and the ones that the Honourable Minister mentioned. And I'll say a little more about that in a few moments. So, how can the Honourable Gentleman get up and say that we have been ignoring the deaf community? And it's rather good to say things in the context of trying to score party political points. And I see him shaking his head, but that's what he said. So when you first thing is when you want to make a party political point, you're going to make a serious party political point. And so let us reflect on what we found when we followed them into government. We found absolutely no provision whatsoever. No provision whatsoever. We were elected into government, and immediately, the Honourable Gentleman started to make provision for Minister language to be provided as events for the government. And there are other people to help us with this, because that's one of the challenges. But immediately, we were provided with the sign language on National Day and on other occasions. I don't know, Mr. Speaker, whether in saying that we have ignored people who are suffering from hearing loss, etc., the Honourable Gentleman has forgotten that in our manifesto for the 2015 election, we had considerable provision in respect of the deaf. And indeed, in our manifesto for the 2019 general election, I imagine that this is we want to forget these things because I'm talking about elections that they lost, so they don't like to think back. But we had even more provision in page 109 of our manifesto about working with people, examining legal with deafness, screening children for deafness, having and hearing loss, hearing aids, and services for the deaf. And then, Speaker, we set out again that we established the use of British Sign Language in purposes of National Day, and we're committed that this will always be provided for as long as we are in government. So, Speaker, the way that we provide for this to ensure that it continues when we are not in government is to entrench it into legislation, which is exactly what we are doing today. So, Mr. Speaker, I don't think this is that it has support across the floor of the House. But we should, I think, be hesitant to get into a competition of Byrne and Geeta who supports them more or less. In fact, Mr. Speaker, if a competition is what honourable members want, then there's a government that they live with nothing. And the government that we live has incrementally done things and now has brought the bill and is going to pass it. Because I think, frankly, therefore, that it is still behoves all of us to play a part of political game on a day that we have said is historic and silent. Having said that, Mr. Speaker, I'm surprised that you're able to say that this is long overdue. When I have said we're not having a reason, this is the talk before. It's surprising that somebody who hasn't made a motion, who hasn't campaigned on this issue, and who hasn't even brought a motion, says that something is going over there. When he's doing that, one just must have been able to do for her to do something about it. And in saying that at least, which I do recognize, is the right approach, we are recognizing the rest of the
indeed that we are taking this forward, and I hope that this framework, because it's only a framework, provides a basis for us to move forward and indeed deliver that package of support for people who have these hearing issues. In saying that, and I know that the Chief Minister, in his contribution, he seems to take many opportunities to engage and rise in the debate beyond things that are not in the principles itself. He may criticize my honourable colleague, Mr. Phillips, for having taken a particular stance. He may not have liked the comments that he was making, but he also expects Mr. Phillips' comments were restricted to the subject matter of the bill. But he welcomes the team who improve the planning process. What to do with the bill? But if you really want to get to the lesson on who opened up the planning process, then it wasn't unfair, because when we inherited the government in 1996, we set the objectives for regions on public participation, which the government proved. And under fiscal courage, we put subsequently in 2011, but that didn't happen again in 2011 when the honourable member took that care. The general people are not first elected in 2011. So, I mean, we can all talk to everybody to say, this is and when one of the members talks about the motion that my colleague, Mr. Phillips, presented on British sign language in relevance to the principles of the bill, that he can't, this is important, as if we didn't consult me on this motion, it's a peculiar view of democracy, Mr. Speaker, because of democracy. This is what we're supposed to do as parliamentarians of this side of the house. We're supposed to do this. All the government reduces your power. Sometimes we can get them sometimes we want. Sometimes we can get them, sometimes we can't. But you know, motions can be prevented by just staying in the draft motion. Then it can be prevented because it's our democratic function. Or it can be that is only willing to agree a motion when he's first put in, because I would say, Mr. Speaker, that's slightly peculiar form of democracy, because it might be that I find a motion which says, I never thought of this, and it's a good motion. If I was speaking on that side, I would say, this explanation is by all things, I can think of it supportive. But he is saying, in a slightly worse kind of view, of democracy that unless we negotiate one thing, it's not willing to go behind himself in a top political platform kind of view to show no justice for what is sitting in the top that we've been elected to do what he wants to do. Not a thing. Mr. Speaker, and they would go on to talk about what they've done in sign language and so on. Look, I congratulate them for things that they've done in the positive sense. I honestly do congratulate them if they made improvements for people who are vulnerable people in this community, or people who want things. But the important part of that point, and the rest is that it is not left off by the point. Let's take a lesson from the honourable members on the other side and all that. They said, I've never been on the district. The government has done no wrong. I mean, it needs to calm down. It needs to calm down, Mr. Speaker. We judgment on this issue without the agreement. We need to calm down, Mr. Speaker. Thank you.
government.
This is the government yesterday, government of Oxford, termed this bill, which was something landmark and represented a positive progress into party territory as part of political principles. It's because not something that I would have wanted to deal with it in that way, but given what the Honourable Member Mr. Phillips in no intervention made it part of political, I'm left with no choice but to answer this point that he wrote it in that respect. Because Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman started by saying that this is not my political principle, but proceeded to make two party political points. The first one, Speaker, was his attempt to take credit for the presentation of the government, Speaker. So, in one of the members managing this, Speaker, this government, that has been for foreign policy, a ministry for foreign policy, both of whom enjoy an excellent relationship with NGOs in this respect, and who were already working on this. He ignores that point, he ignores that point, he ignores the reality, and he wants to believe himself, and by extension, he wants the community to believe, that what will be triggered for this system, and they therefore have a responsibility to call for. Given that I am the minister presenting this bill, that nothing could be further from the truth. And rather, Mr. Speaker, regrettably, rather than the leader of the opposition, aggressively tells us that the motion was ignored, Mr. Speaker, the point that we need to make is that, Mr. Speaker, I will quote or paraphrase what the Honourable Gentleman said, because he said, in an ideal situation, we would have said, agreed to the motion and said, oh, this is fantastic, we agree with the motion. But then, it's the reason that we didn't reply to the motion was because the system can't set a protocol and Parliament etiquette and courtesy and extend it. The honourable member opposite informed us that the GSD, Mr. Speaker, has some autonomous machinery, I can never say six.
I have to say that it is really
then I would have said, don't worry about it, we are already working on this thing, and therefore, if you think that honorable gentlemen will not pretend to take the credit for the government bill that has been presented today, because work was already a well on frame, because this is the business of the Ministry for Equality, who are already engaged with Anita and other stakeholders in this, because there were other people who were speaking to in this respect. And the foundation work had already been commenced. So, absolutely not, Mr. Speaker, the person who presented this bill, I can tell the honourable gentleman very clearly that he was not the trigger for it. And it was the advice of the Ministry of Home Policy and the people who are engaged with who were the trigger for it. Mr. Speaker, you also, the honourable gentleman, Mr. Phillips, also made another point to be tried to make part of this report, and which is indeed inaccurate. Quite apart from clearly not listening to what was said in my original speech, as well as what I said in answer to my question last year, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Phillips says that we cannot provide written and language integrity. He did not accept, and you've heard it not just from myself, but also from my friend, one of the members, in the public debt, that when he was in different health, we know the legends of the entire provision. He did not get the sense of authority because, in fact, it did not exist. So, what we have is a contract between the health authority and provider for DSL. We have a relationship with someone who uses DSL needs to be a doctor. Make arrangements in advance by text message, notify the Gibraltar authority that they need to see a doctor, so the appointment can be made for an electronic intervention in this report email. So there are arrangements for them to be able to make electronic appointments. And there are arrangements for them to be accepted, and therefore, in the meantime, as much provision as possible, arrangements will be made for people to put a bridge. Language interpreter to be there to assist. Sometimes, of course, if it's an individual urgent situation, and this is an emergency, then that may not be possible, to make those arrangements. But look, so, and that this is what we've done as an alternative to that in other contingencies, is that we have a pack where British sign language interpreter will be available online. So, we need to put one of the gentlemen to try and pretend to the community that there are no facilities for people who require British sign language is not accurate, and therefore I cannot use that announcement in this house. Mr. Speaker, it was more eloquently put by the leader of the opposition when he said that more assistance can be provided, and that is what I said in this speech. Of course, and this is not our starting point, this is a progression, Mr. Speaker, of our starting point for 2011. And all the things that we've done in relation to progress in British Sign Language, and we are now entrenching it in private and legislation. So, as the Chief Minister said, we're about longevity and austerity, and it is because it is now on our statute book. That is an accurate reflection of what we've done, Mr. Speaker, and therefore, so the Honourable Gentleman is trying to pretend as well. Mr. Speaker, on the final point, the Honourable Gentleman seems not to have read the bill. This is the bill. Make provision for accountability. And Section 3 of the bill clearly states how the public authority of the bill places this responsibility on. It is one of the gentlemen mentioned to the institution, and they are, of course, captured by that by the bill. There is provision for accountability, and therefore the government will have to hold the entities to account to ensure that the intention of the government in passing this law is actually happening. So I hope that the Honourable Gentleman now understands and is assured of the intention of the effect of this legislation. But Mr. Speaker, I cannot emphasize enough where on a day when we could all be together as a parliament, to have spoken about the progress that we are making in the inclusion of people who
having disability by the party officer and being dragged down by the member opposite because he wanted to make fast political points, because he wanted to take the credit for the work that the government is doing. Thank you.
I'll put the question about the Bill of Parliament to recognize the British sign language as the language of Gibraltar, to require the Minister for Equality to report on the promotion and facilitation of the use of British sign language by public authorities, and to require guidance to be issued in the notion that British sign language be read a second time. Those in favour, those against, carry. The British Sign Language Act 2022.
The Speaker, I would like to be noted that the committee say and urgent of the bill be taken to read in all honourable members.
To all honourable members agree that the committee state and third reading of the bill be taken to do. A bill for an act to amend the pension widows and orphans act. The honourable chief minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the answer to the bill for an act to amend the pension. Widows and
Orphans Act, the first time. Now, which is that the Bill for an Act to amend the Pension Widows and Orphans Act be read a first time. Those in favour, those against, carry. The Pension Widows and Orphans Amendment Act 2020. Now, the Speaker will also move that the bill be now read a second time. The Speaker, this is a short bill, and it is the first bill that is designed to give effect to my commitment in the budget speech of 2007 to bring about legislation to enable a widows and orphans provision to be open to certain members of the community who had an instant intention to was to be covered by the provisions of the what is known as WOT. And I recall, Mr. Speaker, that at the time that we first had debate in this House about this matter, you were at that stage the clerk, not elevated yet to the role of Speaker, and the former Chief Minister used to remind us all in the House that you were the last remaining member of the civil service on what? Mr. Speaker, in 2017, I said during the course of my budget address at Member of 505 and 506 the following. Anything relating to pension, Mr. Speaker, the government has been approached by a number of those entitled to the end of the widow orphan and orphan's pension scheme, who were not married to their current partners at the time that they retired. The law states that any marriage of the pension owner's right would be assigned to a widow or orphan who has not married by the time he retired would not be eligible to entitlement. This grossly unfair is based on an old law which has not yet taken modern life. In fact, Mr. Speaker, the political bill comes in 1961. It is then made up to look at effectively a handful of those who will be able to his old watch scheme. The law will therefore be changed to allow for marriages after the retirement of the contributor if he has opted back into the scheme. The window for the end of the WOT scheme will get open again from midnight tonight until the 30th of September 2017 to allow those who have previously denied membership on the basis of the application of this aspect of the law. And that was done, Mr. Speaker. And subsequently, we published the bill, which fell when the general election was called in 2019. And we then republished the bill in February 2020, which would deal with the changes that needed to be made. The Honourable Mr. Thiessen asked me about the progress of the bill at the last session of the House, and having regards to the bill that was still outstanding, to be as soon as possible for us to do this. Mr. Speaker, of February 2020, we're almost exactly 6 weeks before the pandemic began. And I hope that helps the House to understand this. The reason why this bill has not progressed, we have done a precious little of the ordinary legislating that we do in this time. We've got an extraordinary bill that we had to deal with. Indeed, in 2020, we didn't even have an appropriation, we had an emergency appropriation. And if you think, as I've already said, we've already given a commitment to them, but if we registered in time, that the absence of the bill would not prevent us from giving them the benefits that they might have hoped. And so, Mr. Speaker, I believe it's now time for the bill to be passed. Honourable members, it is actually a bill which has very little effect. It has the effect of making some amendments to deal with the issue that I raised in my budget. I'm committed under the relevant provisions of resumption of contribution for that is relevant, although I don't think there's anyone in the service who will be involved in that. And so, Mr. Speaker, I move that the House should now approve this bill, which I think is one that of all sides of the needs to be put in place with respect to this part of the budget thing, which it has to be done.
Before I put the question to any honourable member, this is speaking of the general principles and merits of the bill. The honourable Daniel Peter.
I think of the opposition is going to be voting in favour of the bill. It's a very welcome bill, and it would be very welcome in particular to those that are affected by it. Mr. Speaker, I have had an opportunity now to consider the bill in the light of the statute that it is in. And in my view, it does deal with a concern that, that I have in the back of my mind, in my joint one room interpretation, is telling me at the end of the day, we're not here. Although we are here to, of course, make political points. In the right way, we're not here to make political points that may cause concern amongst those that may be affected. And the point that I was concerned about, Mr. Speaker, was that the commitment by the Honourable Chief Minister was made in 2017, as he rightly said, was only published a bill, but that bill went by the wayside because the House dissolved and the bill had to be brought to Parliament. And the new bill was then published in 2020. Whether the time period in 2017 all the way to today in 2022 had the potential to cause a prejudice, in particular to the widow of those contributors or the public servant or ex-public servant that may have died from 2017 to 2024, whenever the bill is in fact taken. But in fact, Mr. Speaker, the combination of the amendment together with 18L2 of the Act that we're amending, in fact, will allow the contributor's widow to make the contribution. If her or his wife or whoever it may be a partner, in fact, has died in that 5-year period. And I have been suggesting in expressing my view that that is the effect of the amendment when taken together with the principal act. And for those reasons, Mr. Speaker, I have been suggesting in saying on behalf of your position that my view is supporting the bill.
The Honourable
Speaker. To say that from the Honourable Gentleman, I think I've given an invitation to say that he's faced concerns and he's not concerned, but I'm very pleased that he has deconcerned himself in that respect. Mr. Speaker, what I would say is that one of the things that they have always criticised that we introduced this possible commutation was enabled that there are less people who are going to be interested in respecting this particular bill going forward. It is true that they were not supportive of that, but I think it's worked very well for them. They were not supportive of many things that have worked so well, not least just a number of the things that we need to say about the future job strategy and their own commutations and how they were going to learn. So I'm very pleased to think about that.
I now put a question, which is that the bill for an act to raise the pension with the law for the act. Somebody is taking time to vote in favor. Just again, carry. The pension with the Corporate Amendment Act 2020.
Thank you. earlier in the month. Is that content? Is the government content with that?
The government configures of the ones in the state may not be
convenient, but it may not be possible to move them, but we will obviously try and come back to the appropriate debate, appropriation debate on dates that all members can be here as possible.
I'm going to propose a question, which is that this house is now adjourned even green. I'm going to put the question, which is that this house is now adjourned even green. Those in favor?